And also, yes, I wanted to show Mar Malcolm if you want to take a look. When we spoke just about Tarumis, and I tried to scan it last night, it just wasn't successful, so maybe I'll find some other way. But that article that I mentioned about Tarumis in the Journal of and Taurus Adam La'adam journal is definitely worth reading. But an add Mar Malcolm to that, besides that, so we discussed a little bit what is the Toelis and the Tarumis. So there is a tshuva of Rav Moshe Sternbuch, which you might want to take a look at. It's in Chelek Hay in Simon Shinai and Dalit of his Tshuvas van Hagos. So I think that's the latest volume that exists of the Tshuvas van Hagos. So he talks about the Mechusar Amana and these kind of things, these basic issues, where we discussed it a little bit in Bikiyas in the fourth parak, and it has some type of correlation to the Sugya as well, about if you say it's mutter to curse the guy, that's the Sugya in the fourth parak. It says Amisha Parah is a Klala, and that is permissible, even though that's normally Aser. So he writes in this tshuva that the whole premise is that the only reason it should be mutter is because of the toelis involved, that you hope the guy is going to change his mind. You hope the person is going to decide to retract his retraction. So based on that premise, it's mutter to curse him. So it's just along the lines of what we discussed yesterday about trying to figure out what the purpose of the, or what we discussed really earlier, about what the purpose of Tarumis is. Is it stam, did we let you bear a grudge and speak Lashon Hara for no reason? Hard to believe. So there is some function in it. So the function he assumes in the context of this kind of klala and the like is that there is the hope that the guy will change his mind. And therefore the halacha is saying that you have the right to play a little bit of hardball in order to get him to change his mind. You can't get Bezdin to force him to act differently, but there are certain tools available to you, and this is one of them, and therefore he says it also has to be after Hasra. You have to kind of warn him that this is what could happen, that essentially he's open to such type of tactics because he acted without faith in that context. Now again, that's not something that automatically applies in our sugya, but we discussed a little bit the potential overlap and when it does and when it doesn't. But just it's worth noting also in the context of all those issues. I think there were a couple heads up, so Jonathan, you first.
According to that svar, then if you're dealing with Dover Abba and the thing is already Ne'avad, so they wouldn't really have a function anymore, because what's the point of sort of warning him if he already...
Although, in the case that Agamar is talking about, it sounds like you still have the hope to keep it from being lost, something that will be lost.
Right, right, but if it's mostly past that point, then...
Right, that's not necessarily what we're talking about. Right. Now, let's assume we're talking about a case where, in the case of the workers in that direction, it's about him paying them so he can always pay them later. In the case of the Baal HaBayis, it maybe has a more limited time frame, but that still could happen within that time frame. Was W's hand up before? Okay, so Aaron.
Which Hasra? What can Hasra do
here? I assume he doesn't mean the formal Hasra in the sense that we have by a Mises Bezdin kind of Hasra.
So, what, how does Rav Moshe understand
that the idea, well, specifically about this Mechusar Amana Mishapara thing, but we discussed that there is possibly some overlap or possible overlap between the two, so that the idea of klala, which is what the Gemara invokes in the context of Misha Parah in the fourth parak, that klala isn't just dam, you curse the guy for nothing. It says the reason you can curse him is the hope that your cursing him will provoke him to retract his retraction, to go back on his going back, and to become honest and faithful to his word. So therefore, it's not something that you do without any kind of preparation. You'd have to prepare him, tell him, listen, if you go back on me, I'm going to have the right to curse you, and I will, and hopefully you'll change your mind. Okay, I should just also mention, in terms of this sugya, just an interesting discussion, and just while Aaron had the floor a second ago, so Aaron actually brought this to my attention. You should take a look. It's available on HebrewBooks.org if you want to take a look. Rav Yitzchok Zilberstein, Sfarim are always fascinating, has many interesting things to say about a lot of things. And among his Sfarim, he has Al Hadaf Sfarim. He's read, I think maybe Daf Yomi Sfarim he writes, or the context of Daf Yomi, he talks about Halachic Ha'aretz on the Daf, pretty much the Sfarim that he's released more than half a Shas already, I think, where he talks about something on every Daf. So he has a volume on Bava Metzia as well, which you can download in its entirety on HebrewBooks.org. So in the beginning of this parak, he just has an interesting discussion, which, again, Aaron showed me. It's going to be relevant to some other sugyas we haven't seen yet, but just the point that's relevant here. So he talks about what happens if you have a situation. Our Mishnah says that if the guy backs out on you in a way that causes you a loss, so then that means you have the right to rectify that. either through hiring other workers on their cheshbon or through convincing them to do the work at a higher rate, which you don't actually end up giving them. So he talks about an interesting case. He says, let's say a guy has to go to a wedding of a relative in a faraway town. Let's assume this is an Eretz Yisrael somewhere. And he has to take his whole family. He describes the whole thing in great detail, just if you want to be in the moment. So you're at the bus stop, and you have, there's a schedule of when the buses are going to come and take you to this faraway city. And you're there with all your little kids, and the little kids are screaming and crying. And the first bus doesn't show up. And then the second bus comes, and it's so filled with riders, it doesn't even stop. And then, after that happened already, so now you have the kids are screaming, they're not going to be any patient any longer, and you're going to possibly miss the whole wedding. So he had no choice, so he hires a taxi. So the taxi costs 800 shekel. And if he had been able to take the bus costs 450 shekel. So does he have the right to be toveya that from the bus company?
Or the driver,
right? He talks about whose fault it is, the driver's fault, the bus company's fault. There are a lot of details he gets into, but just what's interesting for our Mishnah is that case itself, that basically the premise is that since he has the right, first of all, he understands this to be a contract, that since this is the responsibility, this bus company has taken it upon themselves to serve the town and posted the schedule, and they don't let other buses then take over that route. So they've essentially made a deal with the customers as a whole to be there at that time. And if they're not doing that, so then this could be considered a chazara of a davar ha'avad. He mentions that the understanding of davar ha'avad could mean monetary value, or it could mean that your plans are no longer possible because of this reversal. So here his plans to go to this wedding would have been lost, so he had to take a quick measure to fix it, to hire this taxi. So he should be able to make them pay the difference. If the taxi costs the same, so it's not going to matter because he paid the bus 450, he'll pay the taxi 450. He was going to pay 450 anyway. But the difference between the 450 and the 800, so that maybe he should be able to be toveya from them, even though it's more than he would have paid in total. And he notes that there is the view in Poskim, the Shach and the Sma have, that the Mishnah sounds like Kidei Scharam, that you can take out of their salary that which you need to pay for the difference. So it doesn't necessarily limit itself to what their salary is. It could go up to even twice their salary, if that's what you need in order to fix things. So there is a basis to say that they would be chayiv to pay. And as the Chazon Ish disagreed, the Chazon Ish didn't see a makor for such a doubling rate. So essentially, it's a little bit of a suffix what the din would be, so you have to have a din Torah about it. Then it gets into the whole question of who's the party for the din Torah, and what if they refuse to go to a bezdin, can you go to our coast? A lot of other interesting details that are discussed, but just the whole premise that the bus company is considered to be a pole who essentially has messed over the client here and nullified their contract, so to speak, is an interesting discussion. We have to get into, we have not yet done the sugya, it's going to be very soon, the sugya of Poel Yachal Lachzer B'chatzi Hayom, of the special benefit that's given to a Poel as opposed to a Kablin, and we'll talk about all the details about that, there's a lot to say, but part of his discussion, we mentioned the basic definition of the difference between a Poel and a Kablin, is that a Poel works by the hour, he's hired for these hours, and a Kablin works by the job. So you give him a job to do, and he does it on his own schedule, basically. However long it takes a long time, takes a short time, whatever it is. So what would you call the bus driver, a Poel or a Kablan?
For you, it's probably a Kablan.
So it's interesting, you say a Kablan, because what's his job? His job
is to take you from A to B.
Right, take you from point A to point B, sounds like he's a Kablan. But we have two different versions of the definition. It's not necessarily going to undermine this.
If he has to be responsible for the schedule, we presume he should get a call.
So that's where it gets a little bit tricky. So he's noted to think he's a Kablan, but what makes it a little bit of a complicated definition is that, yes, presumably, like I didn't say, his job is a specific task to take you from point A to point B, however long it takes. But the idea is he's got to start it at the time when the schedule says he's going to start. So he has to come at 5 o'clock and take people to point B, however long that takes. Presumably, it's still begeder or a kavon. Now, there are other factors, and God willing, when we get into the sugya of kol yachal afsa b'chatzi yom, we'll come back to the shaila. So remember the shaila, but it's just interesting in terms of now about the davar ha'avad aspect of it. Hi.
I don't remember. What was the name of the guy who the
Rav who wrote the tshuva is Yitzchak Zilberstein.
He really thinks that that if, let's say, a bus comes 10 minutes late and that incurs a monetary loss for you, you miss your meeting or something like that, that the bus company doesn't have like the right to would that be a similar case?
So, you know, I think what's bothering you is maybe you think there's a certain understood margin of error.
Yeah, I think Matt, right. Mentioned that in the tshuva.
Right, so that's a little bit subjective. That theoretically could be the case, but he paints this picture which is a little more extreme. The first bus doesn't come at all, second bus doesn't stop, and you say essentially...
Is that also not to be expected, that like that certain that buses, like it happens all the time, buses fill up?
I guess the question is what's reasonable and what's not. So I guess the question is where is their basic understanding that you'll be there, and where is it essentially their fault? So presumably the way he paints the picture, you have a combination so that you're kind of covering all your bases. One didn't come, one came, and one didn't stop. So you have all these things together. Presumably it comes out to at least at some point it was their fault. But the question of is there a basic margin of error in the schedules where you could say it's your responsibility to factor in that a bus, when it says coming at 5, may come at 5:10, yeah, it's probably true. But the question is there an extreme? Sorry? Maybe, although
right, but no other buses can work.
Right, so they're basically creating a situation where they're the market. Don't know if it matters specifically that they're.
The government doesn't like guarantee you bus service.
Right, but that's the question: is that basically once you have this arrangement, this expectation, that's what's going to happen, and you're going to rely on that. And you don't have any other ways of going because this is what's there.
Right, so does that mean, even though that's what you expect, it's not necessarily what the government is like forced to buy?
Well, once they're in the business, you know, then that becomes...
It's not
they don't have to be...
The government's not running a business, they're providing a service.
They may practically be running a business, they're providing a service that they're charging you for. You know, if it was a free service, you probably...
It's paid by your taxes, though.
No, it's not, it's paid by your
sure.
Fare.
I mean, okay, yeah, but also, the whole point is that, like, it's a service that you ask them to provide for you, and that they don't...
But still, even if it's government controlled, it still functions as a normal business, still says we'll do this job and we'll charge you for it. You know, other aspects of the government control may be there also, but it doesn't really. It's not like a library where you come for free. It's not a public service, it's just a...
No, yeah, but even if they find out that it's not being profitable, they still might have the obligation of running bus service.
Maybe, maybe not, but I don't know if that changes the fact that vis-a-vis the customer, it's still essentially we're providing a service, here's what we charge, you pay, here's how we do it, and it has all the functioning of a basic business, regardless of who's controlling it, it seemed like. Well, like a library, you could say, listen, take it or leave it, we provide a free library, you don't pay anything for it, so you have no tines on us. Here, I don't know if outwardly there's any difference. Worth thinking about. Okay, so essentially, just in terms of the details of what we've been talking about here, why it is that a worker should have to get payment, why the Bala Bus should have to pay a worker, if when he pulls out, the worker can't get any other work. So we essentially saw a number of reasons why this should be. And the basic reasons were, one view that there is no such chiyuv, the Shulchan Aruch says there is, but the Ketzos quotes the Maharam of Rutenberg that it's drama, it's causational, and there is no monetary obligation. And we discussed that there does not seem to be basis to say Kimli like that view, which would undermine the whole discussion, would stop everything in its tracks. But the view doesn't seem to be enough for a Kimli in terms of the fact that it's not quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, it's against the Shulchan Aruch. It's not quoted in the Sma or the Shach. It doesn't seem to make the radar screen of the basic bottom line of Halacha. And also mentioned those who point out, it's not even clear that Maharam Rutenberg is of one mind about this, and other Tshuvas he seems to say differently. So that doesn't seem to impact our practice. And then we discussed other approaches, the approach of saying that it's not Grama really, but Garmi, like a number of Rishonim say. And then we talked about different nuances and why it should be called Garmi rather than Grama, why it should be Chayiv, even though it's essentially causational. And then we talked about another approach, which we'll illustrate the difference in a minute. We haven't yet done that. that sees it as a din of davar avid that we have in our Mishnah. That our Mishnah says that if the workers pull out and the materials of the owner are going to go to waste because it's already exposed, so then the workers do have to fix it. And essentially the balabas will either hire, and like we just said about the bus, the balha bias will, or the balha bus will have to either fix it, either with hiring other workers at their expense, or by essentially tricking them into doing the job at the original rate. So the suggestion was that there is a parallel responsibility the other way, that if they can't get a job, so then he has to pay their salaries for that day. And the Maram Shif's question was very helpful in illustrating the nature of that relationship, because the Maram Shif says it's not really parallel. There is no monetary obligation on behalf of the workers. The workers never agreed to pay money. It's just that if they cause a loss, you can make them work somehow or make their salaries used for other workers. But if the balabas doesn't end up doing anything and he ends up losing his property, he can't charge the workers. There's no monetary debt for them. So why is there a monetary debt for the employer? And Xos explains very nicely that essentially it has to do with what the agreement was, that the balabas agreed to pay the workers. The workers agreed to work for the balabas. So essentially what Davar Avid seems to mean is that you can't go back from your agreement if it causes, or to whatever extent, it causes a loss to the other guy. So you have to uphold the agreements. The workers have to actually do the work or let somebody else work off their backs. And the balabas has to pay. So in the case of the balabas, it's monetary because that's what he always would have done. He always would have paid the workers. And in the case of the workers, it's not monetary because they never would have paid him. That's not the nature of the relationship. So the difference between those two, we'll come back to in a minute. That's part of what we want to get to today. But we also discussed the view of the Ritva, that it is essentially a orev kind of situation. That the Gemara talks about a different story. The Gemara elsewhere talks about a case where you have somebody go, Zulshaft, however you pronounce it, somebody goes to the city where they sell cheap wine. He sends a messenger to buy cheap wine for him, and the messenger fails to do it. So now the guy has to pay more for his wine. So the Ritva says, the Gemara says the Shliach has to pay the difference. And the Ritva says, essentially, this is Midin Arev, the same way you can guarantee a loan, that you'll have to pay if somebody else defaults on a loan after you guarantee it. So too, if somebody loses money because you made a promise, and you gave him a reason to trust you, and you failed, and you fell down on the job, so you have to pay for that also. So just to add a little nuance to that, there is a Mordechai that says something similar, but a little bit different. And it's interesting because it's really similar, but the Chasam Sofer quotes this Mordechai. This is Kuf Yudalid in Bava Kamma. Take a look it up. So the Mordechai is quoted as saying, Chasam Sofer, who supports the Ritva's view, mentioned yesterday, but in the end he says, but the Mordechai sounds differently. So the Mordechai is actually similar, but I assume what the Chasam Sofer means is this a nuanced difference. That the Mordechai says that you could be chayev for a grama if you accept upon yourself as part of a deal that you will pay for such damages, that basically you commit yourself to an agreement with someone else with the understanding that if your lack of follow-through causes a loss, you'll pay for it. So even though that's grama, you'd be chayiv. So I think the reason that Chasam Sofer says that the Ritva and the Mordechai disagree is because the Mordechai's scenario is specifically that you accept the loss. And that the Ritva would probably obligate you even without that explicit acceptance. But other than that, they seem to be pretty much parallel, similar types of reasons without nuanced difference. And then we also mentioned the Nesivus's view that the whole thing is a Takanas Chachamim on both sides, and therefore it's not our job to make everything make sense because it's an institution of Chazal, I guess, to keep the labor market functioning, and therefore that's enough. Okay, so is there a difference between the different reasons that we've said so far? Are there any nafka minas? Are there any situations where one reason will lead you to a different conclusion in practice than the other? Let's talk about that for a few minutes. So one issue that Rabbi Akiva Eiger points out And it's very helpful to illustrate the whole Garmi Davar Avud relationship. Tiv-Eger in his Kedushim to Bav Metzia notes that essentially these are two different reasons. You shouldn't lump them together. Garmi is, as we've expressed so far, a function of Nezikin. Right? It is an element of Hezek. Normally I damage your property, I'm Chayiv, but if it's causational, I'm Pater, but if it's Garmi, I could be Chayiv again. While Davar Avud seems to be essentially a law in Hilchos Poland, that I am obligated to uphold our deal under those circumstances. So he says, for example, what would happen if, let's say, the workers are able to get another job, but in the meantime, between the time when they were originally hired and now, the rate has been lowered. The minimum wage has gone down. So now they're going to make less money because everyone's making less money now. That's the market. So are you chayiv to pay the difference? If the workers are able to get a job, but because the rates all over have gone down, they're going to make less money. Is the original employer obligated to pay the difference between what he had worked out and what they're getting paid now? What do you think? Anybody have any thoughts about that? Michael?
I would say no.
Okay,
the difference between his wage before and afterwards.
So, but if the Balabas is chayiv to cover a davar avid, so then why would you say no? Maybe that's what you say yes. So actually, it's interesting. Rabbi Kiva Eger feels that's a nafkamina between the two, and it's important, Rabbi Kiva Eger, because it really illustrates this difference. That if you say it's midina degarmi, I caused you a loss, therefore I have to pay for it. So I didn't really cause this loss, because the fact that the rate went down, I didn't cause the rate to go down. They're working, they're getting paid, that's the deal. But the Davar HaAvod essentially means that I'm obligated to uphold my initial contract, my initial arrangement. Using the word contract loosely here, not to say there's an actual signed contract, but a basic deal. So then, if that's the case, maybe I am still obligated to cover that. So that would possibly be a difference between looking at it from a Garmi perspective and looking at it from a Davar HaAvod perspective. And that's also just worth emphasizing what that means to say Davar HaAvod. It doesn't mean necessarily that I'm obligated to cover the actual losses. It means that if there are losses, then the original deal sticks. And that could have some other differences also. So in the Sefer Mishpatei HaPoelim, so he raises a question, what would you say if the employer went back on the deal, and when he went back on the deal, there were still jobs to be had, and the workers could have gotten a job. But something else happened all of a sudden after that, and now there are no jobs to be had. Some unusual event. So then, once again, one could argue that Medina de Garmi, he's not obligated, because he didn't create the loss. The loss, as far as his issue, they would have still been able to get a job. There was some external thing that made jobs hard to get. He also notes, the Sefer quotes Darchei HaMishpat, that says, building on Rabbi Akiva Eger, a very interesting Chiddush, that what if there are jobs to be had, but these workers, they try a little bit, they just can't get any. So then, again, maybe it's possible to say it's their mazel that's causing the problem, not anything the employer did to them. And again, maybe Al-Sedina de Garmi, maybe it's not his responsibility. It's an interesting application. In the Sefer, Mishpatei HaChoshen, again, it's a beautiful Sefer, there's a lot of things there. So he goes through various nafkaminas. Some are more compelling than others. Some, as he points out, don't end up making much of a difference. But one point that he emphasizes there, which is interesting, is that some of the Rishonim understand that Dina de Garmi, as we know, Grum is normally Pater. So Dina de Garmi, to say you're chayiv, some understand that to be a knas. In other words, that in terms of straight hilchos nezikin, which is normally mamon, so you're obligated because you caused the loss, you have to fix that loss. Garmi, maybe it means that we have to stop you from being careless. So we impose a penalty, you shouldn't be careless. So if you even indirectly cause a loss, but a little bit more than a stam grama, we'll impose a penalty fine. So if it's a knas, so two scenarios that he discusses there that might make a difference is what if the balabas was a total shogeg in the situation? Gives an example, let's say he hired workers for a certain day and thought it was the other day, and so then he wasn't there that day. But he was completely b'shogeg. It's not clear if there is a knas in a shogeg situation in that setting. Or also, what if there is a situation where the balabas dies? So his inheritors now take over everything. So if it's Medina de Garmi, and that's a knas, so then it makes sense the knas does not pass down to his heirs. But if it's essentially the initial deal, employment contract stands, so then, just like all other chovos, the employer should have to pay. Which opens up a whole interesting discussion about the nature of the Davar Avad, like we said with Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Does it mean basically that the deal sticks? So is this treated as wages, as Schiras Polim wages? Which has nafkaminas. For example, the din of Biyomo Titein Scharo, they have to pay it on that day. They assume in the Mishpatei HaChoshen that that for sure doesn't apply, Biyomo Titein Scharo. It's an interesting question to explore a little bit. If you say that basically it's the original deal, so then you could Luchara make a case that it's treated as straight out wages. You have to figure out why you would possibly argue on that. Hi.
Say they were talking about an issue of Knas. Don't we have the same issue that we said with Sheves? Then it's a question whether or not it would be applicable today, and it just doesn't seem it would fit with everything here.
So the Knas, in terms of, it's a different kind of Knas. It's there's Knas with a capital Kuf and Knas with a lowercase Kuf.
Still enforced.
Right, so there is a knas in the Torah that that we don't do anymore. And then the knas of a contemporary Bezdin, that a Bezdin can impose a penalty that it feels is effective to keep society going. So it's actually interesting, some of the Rishonim say that if a Bezdin wants to impose a lowercase kuf knas, they have to make sure it doesn't look like a capital kuf knas, that it doesn't match the same din of the Torah, because that would give you the impression that the Beis Din is acting like smuchim when they're really not. So even if it was an overlapping area, they could only impose a knas in a way that is different in a perceptible fashion from the din of the Chumash, which itself is an interesting way of illustrating that difference. Okay, the truth is there's a two or three more points I wanted to say about this, but I don't want to keep you late for Bible, so we'll just quickly fill in these points when we start again, and then we'll move into the next sugya from there. All right, everyone should have a wonderful day.